Thank you very much. As you heard, I ought to begin by acknowledging that my presence here tonight constitutes my first serious connection with the Speech and Communication Association, and I have little doubt that the SCA will survive the encounter. I have even less doubt, by the way, that I will be the chief beneficiary of this encounter, especially because I plan to stay around long enough to hear people other than myself do some talking. And this is not said, by the way, as a ritualistic self-deprecation. As you'll hear in a moment, my colleagues, the students, and I at NYU are engaged in a kind of a perilous adventure in the field of communication. And we really do need the advice and empathetic criticism and psychic support that only the members of this organization are qualified to give. And so, though I'm the keynote speaker at your conference, I come not to bring you the word, which I don't have, but rather a whole bunch of question marks, which probably you don't need. Nevertheless, I do so really in the sincere hope that some of you, by knowing about our situation, might be able to help us find our way to a few creative solutions. Now, specifically, what I'd like to do is tell you about the foolhardy, presumptuous, and exhilarating effort we're making at NYU to elaborate a new perspective for studying communication, one that might still make some sense 20 or 30 years from now. In effect, what we're trying to do is work within a new structure for understanding the communication process, a structure that reflects the powerful trend toward reorganizing knowledge that is associated with the ecological perspective. Now, as you may be aware, universities are not always sympathetic to such reorganizing efforts, perhaps because with age they suffer from hardening of the categories. As Kenneth Boulding says in his wonderful book, The Image, it will be a long time before the restructuring of knowledge, which now seems to be underway, will be reflected in the organization of universities. Indeed, it is difficult to visualize now exactly what the appropriate organization might be. But there can be little doubt that this restructuring will eventually have to be recognized officially. Until then, as new structures have always done, will have to live in an underworld of deviant professors, gifted amateurs, and moderate crackpots. And so, well, I'd like to skip the question as to which of these categories I most rightly belong. It's enough to say that at the School of Education at NYU, a most hospitable reception has been given to those of us who have shown a serious interest in doing something unusual in communication. At almost every turn, encouragement has been freely offered by administrators and faculty, and we have even been allowed to invent a new name for our subject, media ecology. And one of the more delightful rewards we have reaped so far is in the fact that both our name and our course of study, such as it is, were adopted whole by Oxford University last summer. We were encouraged, too, by the fact that Harvard University published this year the final report of its program on technology and society. Since that program was established to begin inquiries into many of the same matters we at NYU are concerned with, well, we've almost begun to feel that we're part of the official knowledge establishment. As many of you know, even those in the academic underworld need stroking. And to receive positive reinforcement from the two greatest universities in the Western world, well, it's almost too much to bear. But one must do more than bear it. One must be suspicious of it. All the Oxfords and Harvards and NYUs in the world cannot change the fact that communication as a science and or discipline just barely exists, if it exists at all. And I think our colleagues from more settled disciplines are right in viewing us with circumspection. As Gregory Bateson put it in his book, Steps to an Ecology of Mind, those of us in communication are explorers. And he said, in the nature of the case, an explorer can never know what he is exploring until it has been explored, unquote. Well, among other things, that implies that an exploration can, after all, end up badly. And I do not mean by badly that you start out looking for spice in China and end up in Puerto Rico. I mean your ship may quite easily hit a rock as you leave the harbor and sink within sight of shore. You never know at the beginning if you'll find glory and riches or end up a laughing stock in Davy Jones' locker. But an explorer does at least have a plan and sometimes a great notion. Well, at NYU, we may not have a great notion or even a plan, but we certainly have a starting point. Now, what that starting point is can be stated in a number of ways, but I'm especially partial to its expression in kinesics and context by Ray Birdwhistle. This is what he says. A human being is not a black box with one orifice for emitting a chunk of stuff called communication and another for receiving it. And at the same time, communication is not simply the sum of the bits of information which pass between two people in a given period of time, unquote. Now, it seems to me that as long as communication is conceived of as a chunk of stuff moving this way and that in countable quanta, there is probably no need for a new approach to communication, or any approach for that matter. Each of several academic disciplines, for example, physics, linguistics, psychology, sociology, literary criticism, semantics, and logic, can supply a language and a perspective to describe pieces of the chunk. But once an atomistic view of communication is rejected, and in its place is substituted an ecological view, you have an entirely new set of problems for which there are no readily available conceptual handles. What you need, when it comes right down to it, is a new paradigm. Now, I think you know that a paradigm is a perspective or a model or even a metaphor that serves to define the legitimate problems and appropriate methods of a field of study. Aristotle's physics, Newton's optics, Franklin's electricity, and Lavoisier's chemistry were such paradigms. Each of them gave rise to a scholarly tradition and permitted the passage into maturity of each of their respective fields. But history, I think, tells us that the road to a firm paradigm consensus is extremely arduous, and this is especially so in the social sciences. Take psychology, for example. At the present time, so far as I can tell, there are at least three important paradigms competing to preempt the field. First, there's the tradition begun by Watson and Hull, but which is now known as Skinnerian. Second, there is the tradition known as Freudian. And third, there is the relative newcomer called Rogerian or Maslowian. But each paradigm has its faithful adherents who seem to look with disdain on those who are faithful to the others. Each paradigm starts from a different set of postulates and has a unique language. Freudians talk about instincts, Rogerians about needs, and Skinnerians about contingencies. They barely understand each other, and I don't think they want to. Now, I think somewhat the same situation exists in the field of communication, where we have several similar paradigms, each with its own special language and adherents. I'm sure we're all familiar with the Shannon, Weaver, Norbert Wiener paradigm, which talks about communication in terms of such peculiar words as noise, redundancy, information overload, and feedback. And I assume we also know about the bird whistle paradigm, which uses the methodology and some of the language of structural linguistics as a basis for describing nonverbal behavior, or as he calls it, kinesics. Then there's Irving Goffman's paradigm, which he calls a dramaturgical model, because he likens interpersonal transactions to theatrical presentations. And then there's also the McLuhan-Jacques Ellul paradigm, in which all human behavior is understood as a function of the dominant communication technologies of a culture. Well, there are, of course, a dozen others that anyone in this room could probably name, including those of Eric Byrne, David Berlow, Harold Laswell, and Edward Hall. Now, in reviewing these paradigms as thoroughly as we were able, which incidentally is an education all by itself, it occurred to us that each one of them was seriously limited in one respect or another. Some are merely special cases of larger paradigms. Some are based on purely atomistic assumptions. And most are unable to cope with the full range of communication transactions that we might want to know something about. Information theory, for example, is very useful in looking into machine communication. But it is, first of all, based on a mechanistic input-output metaphor, and is second, I think, next to useless in describing human communication. Goffman's dramaturgical metaphor is quite promising in a number of ways, but it is actually a special case of the role-playing paradigm, and it has nothing to say about men and their technologies. Now, McLuhan has plenty to say about that, of course, but almost nothing sensible about anything else. Moreover, I think his methods are so idiosyncratic that anyone wishing to use his paradigm would hardly know how to behave himself, scientifically speaking. So what we have tried to do is select a paradigm, in this case a metaphor, that would reflect a holistic perspective that would comprehend all communication transactions and that would be useful in organizing research into the widest variety of communication situations. Now, the metaphor we chose, as you might infer from the name media ecology, is, of course, that all communication is an environment. Now, by adopting this perspective, we are not only rejecting the idea that communication is a chunk of stuff, but also the idea that communication takes place in an environment. What we are putting forward is the idea that communication is an environment, from which we have concluded that the study of communication is or should be one of the ecological sciences. Now, I don't suppose that this metaphor will strike any of you as especially startling. Every one of us has probably come across it before. For example, Edward Hall is not far from it, and Marshall McLuhan probably means something like it when he says that the medium is the message. Ray Birdwhistle certainly does when he defines communication as, quote, that system through which human beings establish a predictable continuity in life, unquote. But what's distinctive, we think, in what we're trying to do at NYU is that we've assembled a community of teachers and students who have committed themselves to rigorously exploring the ecological paradigm to see how far it can take us and in what directions. By rigorously exploring, I mean that in all our research, in all our courses, in all our discussions, and in all our writing, much of which incidentally is contained in our publication, The Media Ecology Review, we start from the premise that every communication system and process is connected with every other communication system and process in a complex network, and that the study of communication processes is the study not of elements, but of elements in relationship. Thus, our attention is focused not on who says what to whom, through what medium, etc., but on how the who, what, whom, and medium are interrelated. From the ecological perspective, content analysis, for example, is viewed as either trivial or irrelevant. What matters to us is context, and to the extent that media ecology has as yet a methodology, that methodology might be called context analysis. Now, this implies looking at communication environments as systems within systems within systems. It means trying to identify the significant characteristics of each system as a whole, the subsystems of which it is composed, the larger system within which it functions, and all the significant relationships among them. And to make things even more confusing, context analysis takes as its subject matter the transactions between individual and reality, between individual, individual and group, group and group, group and culture, and culture and culture, and tries to see all of these as functions of one another. Moreover, context analysis, or media ecology, gives special attention to the roles played in each of these transactions by the media through which they are conducted. By media, we mean any agent or agency through which two or more discrete elements are linked in a transacting system. Communications media include, therefore, both technologies like film, radio, and television, and techniques, which are media composed of a set of procedures. I suppose one might call techniques soft media, although they are no less compelling than technology itself. The technique known as operant conditioning, for example, is a medium which links behavior A to behavior B. Parliamentary procedure is a medium connecting event A to event B. And the medium known as Aristotelian logic links statement A to statement B. Thus, from our point of view, a technology or a technique is an environment within an environment. Now, to try to give you a concrete illustration, because I think that's what's needed, of how context analysis works, let me choose the environment you and I presently find ourselves in. Now, to begin with, I'm reluctant to give this environment a name, because by naming it, I will prejudice the analysis. For example, if I call this environment the keynote address, or even Postman's keynote address, I would impose on it the tacit assumption that the content of Postman's words is probably the most important element in the environment, which is quite probably not true, by the way. Moreover, by naming the environment the keynote address, I would effectively obscure the role that the addressees have played in making the address what it is. And not only that, by calling it Postman's address, I might foster the impression that the role you play is essentially passive, a matter of merely recording what I say, which is, of course, not what is actually happening. Now, I don't want to dwell too much on this point beyond observing that the name one gives to the system one is looking at usually turns out to be an element in the system itself, because it always gives some degree of direction to the observations one will make. Let's say then that this environment is our keynote address and leave it at that, although a good media ecologist would never leave it at that, because one of his first concerns is to specify the effects of his own behavior as an observer, including his naming behavior, on the system he's observing. In any case, one of the first questions we now have to ask is, what is the largest system of which this environment is only a part, and what is the relationship between them? Well, obviously, this system is part of the larger environment called the 9th Annual SCA Summer Conference. And the apparent function of this speech is to mark the beginning of the larger event. Now, this fact calls attention to an invariable characteristic of all communication environments, namely that they all have boundaries, more or less arbitrary dividing lines signifying the end of one system and the beginning of another. College graduation ceremonies, doctoral orals, and wedding ceremonies are boundary markers of the most obvious and formalized kind. Dressing for dinner, signing in at conventions, and events like this speech are boundary markers of a more subtle kind. But they all serve the same function, and that is to define the environment one is about to enter. They signal, in effect, that a certain set of behaviors and not others are in order. But one of the important functions of our keynote address, then, is to mark the boundary between conference and non-conference. Now, this seemingly simple observation suggests a number of interesting questions, among them this. If this event is primarily a boundary marker, is it the most effective structure that can be found to do the job? Well, of course, to answer that question, one would have to answer the question, what is the function of the larger system, the 9th Annual SCA Summer Conference? Now, that, I'm sure, is a very complex question, because depending on who you are, the answers will be very different. They will range from, I've always wanted to go to Chicago, to, it's good to have this on my record, to, let's get away from the kids for a weekend, to, I need some contacts for a job. All very good purposes. I doubt, incidentally, that the formally stated purpose for holding this conference is the compelling reason for bringing most of us here. The formal declaration of purpose is more in the nature of what media ecologists would call a binding strategy, or for short, BS. Now, nevertheless, one of the functions of the conference as a whole is to serve as a boundary marker within a larger system. For example, this conference draws a line between those of us who are committed speech communication professionals and those ordinary standard brand slobs who stayed home.